Time to take a look at weather and maybe continue our discussion that raged on in the first hour of the show that had to do with climate. Weather guys are back to talk weather and climate. John Martin, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, one of our guests. John, good to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
And Steve Ackerman, former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison, also, of course, an emeritus professor in atmospheric and oceanic sciences department. And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here on this lovely day.
As we talk with our experts, I hope you'll join in. Questions for them about weather or climate, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. And before we go to the phones, let's take a minute or two to talk about Hurricane Helene. Hit Florida and Georgia, I think 140-mile-an-hour winds, flooding, killing now, CNN is today is reporting at least 115 people died in that. And this is, how does Hurricane Helene compare to previous Gulf Coast hurricanes?
I think Helene is the strongest storm that's ever hit the so-called Big Bend area of the Florida coast. And that's not a small thing. That's a little bit of a, you know, coastal funnel. Luckily, the terrain doesn't get high very fast there. But this storm was not only really intense, almost a Category 4, I think, when it made landfall, but it was also moving forward very fast. And what that means is that it moves the storm surge that is tied to the storm itself, yeah, because the pressure is so low at its core, it raises the ocean height underneath it. And if that starts moving forward at a great speed, and it was on the order of 30 mile per hour forward speed, that just makes the storm surge even more devastating for such an intense storm. And that's what I think we're finding out now, is that the flooding is so extensive and over such enormous areas, partly because of the heavy rainfall, but partly also because of the storm surge in places that are many miles from the coast. And so a really devastating event. I'd say it's probably, for that part of the country, one of the most intense storms they've ever experienced.
I read that it was tied as the 14th most powerful hurricane to hit anywhere in the U.S.
I could imagine that. Mm-hmm. Again, how do you define that in terms of precipitation, pressure differences, winds? And, you know, as extreme as it was, it was well forecast.
Exactly.
The National Weather Service, the Hurricane Center, was saying this is going to be a bad storm even before it was a hurricane.
Right. If this thing had hit in 1940 the way that it hit just last week, we'd already be in the thousands of deaths. Easily.
And Once a hurricane gets so far, in this case, I think it got to the Carolinas and Tennessee, then it becomes a tropical storm?
Yeah, they can get downgraded in their intensity. And, you know, the opposite happens over the ocean. You kind of upgrade from a tropical depression to a tropical storm to a hurricane and so on. But once these things make landfall, they quickly get robbed of their main potent fuel, which is warm sea surface temperature, and the evaporation that comes off of that. That fuels the storm, but also there's a considerably stronger friction in the lower part of the atmosphere over vegetated surfaces and surfaces with buildings and hills and so on, and that really gets in the way of the inflow of air into the storm, and they rapidly decay. In addition, this particular storm did a little bit of a dance with an extra tropical disturbance in the middle and upper troposphere that was to its northwest, and that continued the circulation of the storm. They had a concert scheduled for Friday night in St. Louis, right at Busch Stadium, that was canceled because of the winds. They couldn't set the stage up. And so that was not directly the hurricane, but indirectly the hurricane. And so that was a combination of the extratropical and the tropical menace that they conspired to produce in the southeast United States over the whole weekend.
Wow, I had not heard that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting circumstance with this thing.
Well, another interesting thing, you were talking about the circular kind of wind, but there were active tornado warnings too. How does a hurricane create a tornado?
It's almost the same reason why the hurricanes die, ironically. Stronger friction with the ground with really intense horizontal winds, it makes it easier to spin up these little vortices. They tend to be not very damaging tornadoes, but they do tend to be kind of numerous. and they'll come in flocks like they did this weekend. Yeah. So
that's not an uncommon thing. They'll have thunderstorms embedded in them. So you're right, but they're Category 1 type.
Usually weak tornadoes. But, you know, if you've already had a soggy ground and you've got a couple of roofs off and whatever and the trees are already leaning, an F0 tornado can do some damage you'd rather not have.
Weak tornado by what standards?
It just adds to the misery these poor people, our fellow citizens, are experiencing down there.
Absolutely. Well, Dean in Evergreen, Colorado has a question, may relate somewhat to that, but I think to some other areas. So let's go to Dean. Thank you for calling.
Hi, folks. Yes, I'm in Evergreen, Colorado. And we, by the way, had our first taste of winter in the higher country with snow. And maybe, who knows, in 4 or 5 months, you guys might have a day of winter. but on that note, I've had to hold this question in for, I guess, 2 months when we last had the weather guys with us. And thanks for taking my call on this. I had a question about the rate of warming, and that we had this big step up in the past 2 years in the rate of global average temperature. And I think it jumped up like 0.2, 0.3 degrees, which is a big, in centigrade, a big jump up. And I had asked you guys what the cause for that was, and I think Larry hit that big red call disconnect button before I got to say something on follow-up. But so you guys responded it was global warming, but I was wondering, as that's a more of a gradual rise, what causes these steps up like this past 2 years ago where we had this big jump and now we've had two consecutive way out there outlying years of very high warmth?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think anybody has a definitive answer to that question. It is true that there's a background warming that's going on that certainly encourages those kinds of records to creep up and catch us. But there's enormous amounts of variability in the atmosphere, even without global climate change. And so there might be, you know, a couple of years in a row or an isolated year that really does kind of cause you to scratch your head and say, how could we be 0.2 degrees warmer on average around the globe this year? But when that happens simultaneous with a background change, it makes you think that this isn't going to be such an isolated thing. We're going to start to see this occur and crop up a little bit more frequently because there's an encouragement on the very large scale to make this kind of record possible. So I think, Dean, it's probably fair to say that, you know, those last couple of unusually warm years are related to the climate change that's going on in the background, but probably not entirely and uniquely related to that. There's probably something else going on in there, and we have to kind of do a little bit of investigating to figure out what those extra supporting factors might be.
Yeah. And Dean, you had another question as well, if I'm not mistaken, about moonbows?
Yeah. So I'm a sailor, and ordinarily we're up at Lake Superior sailing with our boat for extended periods. But this year we're at home, and one of my colleagues is sailing from Fiji over to American Samoa. And he told me he saw a moonbow. And I was sort of scratching my head. Is there enough chromatic, from the sunlight, sun's reflection off the moon isn't as chromatic as direct sunlight? And I was wondering if a moonbow, which is kind of a rainbow at night from moonlight, is that actually more of a, does that actually have color?
You know, that's a really good question. I'm not sure. I think it would be hard to see the color. You would obviously need a full moon. You would need to get as much intensity as you can. You need a pretty darn clean atmosphere so you don't get any scattering with aerosols or anything. I have seen like a halo around a moon, a full moon. So it's possible to see those colors. But that's a good question.
Well,
a couple of those characteristics would
be met in the South Pacific, you'd think.
Right.
Pristine air would be one.
Then
no light pollution. So that might reduce the background competition a little bit. Imagine seeing that. That would be wild.
It would indeed.
If you're ever going to, that's probably the place you're going to see it.
I saw a 90% complete rainbow circle.
Wow.
From an aircraft flying down to an experiment in southern Florida.
Wow.
And it was, you know, fat, all, everything was just at the right angles.
Yeah.
You know, and there it was, and I just got so excited, and I, of course, couldn't get my camera out in time. But.
Dean, thank you so much for calling. Kind of relating to Dean's question, I guess, in a way. Michael had emailed that very early yesterday morning, they were in a foggy valley, and as the fog lifted, there was a white arc in the sky, the same shape as a rainbow, but all white.
That's a fog bow. And so because the fog droplets are smaller, you don't get the separation of the light. What you get is just the white rainbow, right, white scattering. Yeah.
Wow, very cool.
Very cool,
it is
indeed.
Really cool. Yeah.
I've not seen that.
Yeah, I've seen it once, I think. You know?
Wow.
Louise in Dodgeville, it's your turn. Hi, Louise.
Hi, I have a question, and I was wondering if you could maybe help me with, like, the science of this. I was thinking about global warming, and I know some people are like, oh, whatever, it's just going to be warm, I'll turn my air conditioning on. But what's happening is, like, heat is energy, so is it really... The global warming is putting more energy into our weather systems? And would there be, if that's the case, would there be a better term than just global warming?
I'm trying to think now whether or not be a better term. I think one way to think about global warming, particularly in terms of impact on weather systems, is the warmer the atmosphere is, the more water vapor that's going to be in there. And so even if the circulation patterns didn't change, which they are going to change because you don't need to move energy around as much out of the tropics into the polar regions. More moisture in the atmosphere, you're going to get more precipitation, heavier precipitation.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't know if there's a better term either, but I think it's a pretty good one because it is maybe the primary manifestation of what you're seeing going on as the atmosphere's composition changes and we retain more of the energy that would otherwise be exported out to space through the atmosphere, and that makes the temperature go up first, and then other things follow from the increase in temperature. As Steve points out, more water vapor in the atmosphere, circulation changes, storminess might change, where distribution of storms and clouds and precipitation, all of that is a downstream consequence of the retention of extra infrared energy, which primarily, or I should say, as first order, increases the temperature of the planet. And so it is a good way to ground the discussion. But if one imagines that all that happens is the temperature changes and therefore you can find refuge with your air conditioner, as you point out, is a nice comment, that's not quite the comprehensive story. There's more to be concerned about because there are downstream consequences to a temperature, a slow but gradual and a persistent global temperature increase.
Yeah.
And I suppose in reference to your previous guest, we could call it the global chemical change. Changing the chemistry of the atmosphere,
right.
Which leads to the
water. And that points the finger a little bit more at us, which might be a beneficial thing for us to consider. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Louise, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email your question. Oh, by the way, your photos as well, because we've got our screen up, and we can. If you got a cloud photo or another weather photo you want us to see, I hope you'll do that as well. Just go to talk@wpr.org and send that along as an email, and we'll be glad to take a look at it. I'm Larry Mueller with my guests, our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, and you can join in, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Taking a look at weather and climate on the show today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Great to have them back. And certainly you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Mike in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. Love the show. Is the political and scientific argument about global warming settled today that it is a fact, and all of these naysayers and people that said it wasn't true, if they shut up or...
So I think, you know, with the fact part, definitely on the science end, there's no question, and there's been no question for many, many years. I think on the political end, I think you're seeing less and less skeptics or pushbacks. That's not to say they don't exist. They do. They just doesn't seem like they have as strong a voice.
Well, yeah.
And I don't know if that's in the right analysis. It's more of an experience than that.
Yeah, maybe it's more experience and luck. But I think, you know, I agree 100% with Steve. The scientific question is no longer a question. I mean, it's 100% certitude. And what we do about it is still open to question. And we need everybody's voice and everybody's energy to help us solve the problem. But we, you know, there is a political aspect of this that is intransigent to the fact that it's real. In fact, I heard that this document, this Project 2025 document, wants to pretty much commercialize and dismember NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the National Weather Service, because they consider NOAA, whoever wrote this thing, consider NOAA to be at the font of what they call the climate alarm industry. And so that suggests to me that there are powerful people lurking, waiting for an opportunity to get themselves empowered to get rid of a discussion about this pending and ongoing threat. That makes me very nervous. And it certainly compels me to be thinking about next month in a way that I wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah. And you should be nervous, I think.
Absolutely.
The science, I mean, there's a lot of things with regard to the science of, like, how do we deal with this, right? Because it's going to impact how we live socially and economically.
That's
and
right.
Energy-wise.
And those questions, we need everybody's
tough.
Input.
Yeah, those are tough questions.
Yeah, and I want as many people thinking about that as possible. Yeah. But we have to stop wasting our time arguing about whether or not there's actually a threat. There is a threat. And we can discuss it in really clear and concise, accurate scientific terms. There's no question about that anymore.
You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. I want to turn our attention to heat waves, marine heat waves, because you guys wrote about this a couple of weeks ago, and I thought it was kind of interesting. In the Wisconsin State Journal, in your column there.
This was a fascinating thing to me because I hadn't heard about it until I was doing some research about the ocean temperatures and how much warmer are they now than earlier. And, you know, we've all experienced heat waves in the atmosphere because we've lived through them, unfortunately, if some people haven't, because sometimes they get very, very severe. And in the process of doing that, I found out that, there was these things called heat waves in the oceans. And it's where a section of the ocean gets really warm, not just at the surface, but deep into the ocean as well. And this happened off of the west coast of the U.S., of North America, in the Pacific. And it was so big, I don't remember what the size was now, but I do remember what the oceanographers called it. They called it the blob.
Was that 2014-15-ish? I remember that.
So it happens. And again, that's one of the interesting things I think about is we look at global change and it's the connection between what's going on with the atmosphere, the land surface, the ocean surface, and the cryosphere. And there's still a lot to learn with regard to those other three, I would say.
Yeah.
Well, and doesn't it have an effect then on hurricanes, for example?
Yeah, so it's providing that really not only sea surface temperatures that are warmer, but the depth of it. So when a hurricane goes over it and it mixes up that water, it's still pulling up warm water from below and not cold water. And that, if it was pulling up cold water, it would shut down the storm or weaken the storm.
Let's take a look at the photo that we have.
That's a fog bowl, I would say.
Lisa in Sheboygan emailed a photo of a fog bowl that took over Lake Michigan.
Yeah. Very cool.
And so it is that white. Actually, it's broader than I thought, at least the one that I saw on, because that is pretty much the same thickness as a rainbow.
I've never seen one, so it's my first one, but it's glorious.
Yeah, it's glorious. You just don't get the colors because the fog droplets are so much smaller. Mm. It's like a light going through a prism. You get a nice big crystal prism in your window. You'll get the light color separation because Roy G. Biv's rainbow gets separated out. But these droplets are just too small to do that separation, so you see the white. Just the light gets reflected back.
Very cool photo.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, we're talking about fog. Really, I'm trying to remember my seventh or sixth grade science. Isn't fog just a cloud?
It's a cloud on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the droplets that make up what we call fog are the initial size droplets of clouds. There's no difference between them. Yeah.
The only real difference, I think, in terms of when you think of clouds is how do they form? They form a little differently in clouds. You've got to get the lifting air primarily. Yeah. Here it could be mixing. It could be
cooling
just air,
the ground
cooling
underneath.
Of the ground. Yeah. Moist air running into a really moist cornfield or something like that. But yeah, and that's why they call it advection fogs, radiation fogs, different names by the processes that gets the humidity to get to 100%.
Gary in the town of Ween, we'll go to you now. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Larry, man. Hi, the weather guys. Love your show every month. Call friends to make sure they remember to watch it. In the early 70s, I took a class at UW Stevens Point called Politics and the Environment. And one day in class, I asked, what's going to happen when we succeed in selling the American consuming patterns to India and China? And in this equation, as we're talking about global warming and the use of resources, no one wants to stand up and say, well, let's just sort of dial it back a little bit. We don't have to have growth and growth and growth. The planet eventually is going to not accept that. And I think global warming is going to be one of many things that we have to deal with. But no one wants to cut back a little.
So, I think there's the political scale and on that end, but I think locally, I think individuals are trying to do things and families are trying to do things. And I'm going to jump back to the 70s because I'll bet in that environmental class, you also talked about the ozone hole and how that, because that was a big discussion in the early 70s, and what do we do about it? And we did something about it. We set something up with regard to changing emissions of chlorofluorocarbons, and that helped the real zone recover in the stratosphere.
Right.
And so it shows we can do something.
It does indeed. And I think one of the things that I got my eye on, and maybe other people share this view, maybe others don't, is that I think there's been an erosion in confidence in expertise in our society. Yeah. And that leads to all kinds of problems, including doubting whether or not a global average temperature increase is going. And there's no doubt about that. And you don't even have to be an expert any longer to have a suspicion that it's right. You maybe have to be an expert to know it's right. But we don't trust experts anymore. And the consequence of that is far-reaching. And it leads us to wonder, is there anything we can do? I think we may not have to particularly slow down. We may find through innovation that's unleashed and with our backs against the wall that we can solve some of the problems that we used to do in sort of old, cheap, clumsy ways in more sophisticated, slightly more expensive on the front end because of research ways. And we can still do things. So, you know, the country used to respond, the world maybe used to respond to challenges, but we can do it because we're smart. Now we seem to be encouraged to think we can't. I don't like that.
Back to the ozone thing, I think that took a concerted effort, but we had worldwide buy-in.
That's
on,
right.
On that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And the threats were, pretty more obvious, if you will. Mm-hmm. And the impacts, I think, were things that people were more easily willing to give up. Your spray cans. I remember that was one of the bigger issues with chlorofluorocarbons.
And industry decided to change the way it did refrigeration.
Right.
It was mandated
to
do so, and it figured it out overnight. How are we going to do this as cheaply or even cheaper than we used to do it? I'm always brought back to my memory of the famous story about 1920, the baseball owners were petrified games would be on the radio. No one will come to the game anymore. They overlooked the obvious fact that they could use the radio as a way to generate advertising revenue.
Right.
And so they found that out pretty quick.
Yeah.
And that's the way things go. We innovate on top of the problems that we have to solve.
And the radio pulled people in.
Lifelong fans. Yeah. And so absolutely right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The same
right.
thing came up with television. When television came in, you can see the game on TV. Why would you go to the game?
Right, right.
And in fact, the opposite.
Exactly the opposite. And it's not always predictable that the opposite will happen, but boy, history seems to give us countless examples of don't worry so much, the opposite may well happen if you kind of design your scheme this way.
My brother, who lives out in North Carolina and is a Met fan, came to the game with Mawarta yesterday when the Brewers won. And so he's watching it. And then when he came back, I pulled up this app so you can see every pitch. You know, almost lifetime and where it goes and what it was called. And, you know, they said, you know, why do you go to the game? You could see it right here. And he looks at me and goes, oh, no, I look at that, at the, you know, in the game while he's in the stadium. Right? He wants to know where was that strike.
Yeah, right. Yeah, my son and I were there yesterday. We know better than the home plate ump, even though we're 300 feet from where from his view. And every time you pull up that app, you're like, yeah, I guess it was outside. All right, we'll complain about something else.
Richard in Downsville emailed to ask you to talk about the Hunga Tonga volcano in South Pacific Ocean that erupted this year. Will the amount of water vapor released by the volcano have an effect on warming and climate in general for the next few years?
So I don't know how much water vapor was thrown out by that volcano, but typically with volcanoes, when we're looking at their global impact, it's the ash and some of the gases need to get up into the stratosphere where they can stay around and reflect solar energy back out to space. And then that can lead to a global cooling. And in fact, we saw that in 92.
With
Pinatubo. You know, we were on track to get to a very statistical global warming data set. 92, it takes off.
Yeah.
You get a little blurb of 0.2 degrees, and now it's like, all right, we got to wait
another
couple of years before it's 90% statistical.
And you have a very good point about lofting it all the way up to the stratosphere where the circulation, though vigorous, it doesn't interact quite the way that the air does in the troposphere with the surface. It takes a longer time for that interaction to happen. I don't know what the residence time of a water vapor molecule is in the stratosphere. Probably doesn't last long because it gets freezed out.
Oh, right, yeah.
But in the troposphere, it's only 9 days. So you can fill the atmosphere with an anomalous amount of water vapor from something like a volcanic explosion, and it's not going to last. It's going to have almost no fingerprint of that, even two or three cycles later, which is 20 or so days. So it just gets incorporated. It's like if you find $10 bill on the street, you know, it becomes part of the main budget of your house. You don't remember that you found it.
I go out and buy a couple of beers right away. I celebrate. Well, otherwise, I will forget.
I was assuming a responsible householder. But you know what I mean?
You've known me too long.
I should have known better.
Oh, man. Kendall in Merrill has a comment or question. Let's go there. Hi, Kendall.
Hello. My question is about the government is trying to tamp down on just residential use of energy. But what about the millions and millions of kilowatt hours or whatever that are being used by these new data centers for intelligent computing and stuff like that? Isn't that using far more than residential use?
Yeah, I would think that it is. I think that's a really big issue.
Yeah, particularly as we begin to develop more and more computer facility centers, which is what's happening.
We had the same sort of feel of being scolded for using plastic straws a few years ago. And, you know, maybe if we can pull back on that as individual consumers, there's nothing bad about trying to do that. I don't like the heavy-handed approach that makes me feel guilty that it's my fault when it's gigantic corporations dealing with huge amounts of plastics that are being a lot more irresponsible than anybody I know. And so I think the same thing maybe applies here. The messaging is important when the message is important. And I think sometimes groups can stumble on that.
Yeah.
Kathleen in Madison, your turn. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. I think I'm a pretty good example of exactly that thing of, you know, there's a lot of blame put on individuals and no responsibility put on the big corporations. I'm pretty poor, and I live in one of the poorest neighborhoods in Madison, and there's three things that I'd like to see the local government do to help people like me who don't have a whole lot of resources. For one thing, it'd be really nice if they would, if someone at some level of government would change it so that the heat assistance that people get in the winter would be extended to help cool our places in the summer. Because you can go to a cooling center during the day, but when you've got a place that doesn't cool down below 80 degrees at night, you really have a hard time sleeping in that.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Very good point.
And what I'd really like to see is that landlords be mandated to increase the insulation in attics. You know, do a carrot and a stick, give a tax credit or a tax penalty, but, you know, when it's 200 degrees in the attic and that's radiating down into my home the whole day and night, that's pretty hard to run my AC against that.
Absolutely right.
And something else I'd love to see just nationwide, but hey, Madison could start this. Why don't we mandate that all new roofing and replacement roofing be made with a really high albedo material? If I've got the high versus low right, something that's going to reflect more of that heat back up as just white.
Yep, all good ideas. And you know what I'll say about underlying all those excellent proposals is that they all reflect a new reality that we're all experiencing here in the beginning of the 21st century that was not a reality at the beginning or middle of the 20th century. Not only the climate's changed, but also the way in which we heat and cool our homes. All those things have changed. And sometimes it seems as that regulatory or governmental agencies respond most slowly to those changes. But these are excellent proposals. And it seems to me they reflect the underlying changes that we're all experiencing in one way or another. So I applaud them.
Kathleen, thank you very much for calling. Different issue here from Chris in Rudolph. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Something a little less serious. And what you're talking about is very serious, and I'm glad you're doing so. Is it folklore, or is there any fact to what I've heard over the years that the height of a wasp nest will tell you how much snow you're going to have for the winter? And what about the woolly bear caterpillars, if they're total black or they're half and half? Got any?
So I know the woolly bear one is, there's no scientific correlation between whether or not you're going to get snowfall based on the length of that black. I know I've looked into that one. I haven't heard about the wasp nest, but if it is right, I know John's going to be out there looking for them.
Yeah, no, I never heard of the wasp nest either. I did hear about the woolly bear, and I was fully 100% invested in that as a kid, and I would be disappointed without cause sometimes because I'd see too much of one color or the other, and then the winter would be okay. But I don't know about the wasp nest. That's really interesting. I didn't think that they came back to their old nests anyway. So it strikes me that physically and biologically, there ought to be no reason why that would even be a benefit if the wasps were able to see that coming. But I'm pretty sure they can't. But I never heard of it before.
And the other thing I think is that, you know, we talk about these as folklore forecasts and sometimes we'll chuckle about them. But it really shows the importance of weather to people's lives, way back, even when we didn't have the capability to do any forecasts, you know, people were looking for signs in nature to give them a hint of what the coming winter or season was going to be.
And you pointed out in the past that there are some of these quote-unquote old wives' tales that actually are correct.
Yeah, so I think the one that comes to my mind immediately is red sky and night sailors delight, red sky and morning sailors take warning.
Yeah.
What that's really telling you is talking about is the movement of the weather systems.
Yeah,
red sky at night, sailor's delight means that the storm has already passed and the good weather's coming. So there are ones that do make sense. Although I would rather get a forecast from John than from a sailor.
Nobody actually would.
Speaking of John, I heard there's a rumor that John usually turns to the Farmer's Almanac for.
He does. He has one. You go into his house and it's like there's a series of them, not just this year's, but the last couple.
I read them serially, and the thing, this is an odious rumor, my dear friends, and I read them serially because they say the same thing every year. You know, someday you're going to get a big blizzard, and the next day it's going to be 50 degrees, and all. None of that stuff's any good. As I've said before, and I love this comes up, the Almanac's a great book. It's worth reading. There's great stories in it. There's great all sorts of other things. But I leave the weather alone. I used to look at it as a kid, and it was nothing but disappointment. And don't forget, the Red Sox were blowing the pennant every single year when I was a kid. So, you know, I didn't need a double whammy. I stopped reading it.
Well, Matt in Suamico has something for us. Matt, hi.
Yeah, I worked for two seasons at Yellowstone National Park, and I can tell you that you can see a moonbow. I saw them regularly the way that I did it was that I would go out on the geyser basin when the geysers were steaming at night and make sure that the moon was behind me.
Right.
And you could see them. They were kind of different shades of violet, and sometimes you'd even see double moon bows.
Wow.
But you can probably do that in your backyard in Wisconsin with a steaming pot, you know, like a kettle of hot boiling water outside, as long as you make sure that the kettle is in front of you and the moon is behind you.
Yeah, that might be. I think it's great that you figured out how to go see them in Yellowstone. I'm not sure about the kettle in your house because it may be too small.
Too small, maybe.
You probably need still a bigger one.
Bigger population of droplets.
Yeah, but it got me thinking because we live over by the north end of Lake Mendota, and this time of year we're getting a lot of fog come rolling out of the cattails area over there.
Yeah.
But I think as you're saying that, I'm thinking that this moon is always in the wrong place. My house is always in the wrong place. I gotta get up, get on a bike and go someplace else.
Oh man.
That's a good idea.
Patty in Rockdale had emailed to say they saw a lunar rainbow years ago over the hills above a campground they were staying at. The strong thunderstorm that actually did damage to campers and so forth in the middle of the night. And as campers came out after the storm to check on each other, a ring of light started coming over the hill parallel to the horizon. And that was followed by more rings of various brightness. It looked like the rings of Saturn, and they filled the sky. Patty wrote that they have searched the photos of an event similar to what they experienced, but nothing has ever come close.
Wow, interesting. Oh. So maybe there was a curtain of rain in the far distance, again with the moon at the back of it, that gave the primary one. And it being remote, you maybe had no competition, but I don't know about the extra rings. That's really interesting.
You know, it would be great to see a picture at some point.
Yeah.
But what's coming to my mind, but this would be during the day from the sun, so you have that intensity.
Mm.
If there are ice crystals in the atmosphere,
in
association with the halo that you often get, you can get all other kinds of bows that intersect that look like there are all kinds of arcs in the sky.
And you know, you get a big thunderstorm, there's a lot of cirrus outflow at the top.
Yep.
So, depending
but again,
on what
I think
direction
it would be hard with a moon, full moon, to get that intensity.
Wow.
Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, our guests. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at weather and climate today with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. And let's go to John in New Elgin, Iowa next. Hi, John. John, are you there? His question had to be, how does carbon and methane get in the atmosphere anyway? Is that trapping heat, and are melting glaciers having an effect?
So, carbon and methane get in the atmosphere through natural processes and human processes, anthropogenic. And so decay is going to put carbon and methane into the atmosphere. And then just consumption of fuels is going to basically do the same thing from an anthropogenic point of view.
Yeah, and some of the methane is trapped in frozen tundra in the high latitudes of the northern hemisphere. And as that melts kind of differentially a little bit more than it used to, you have a little bit more of a methane imposed in the atmosphere through the melting of these clathrates. And they all come from decay, as you point out. Yeah.
Mary Kay in Kenosha, it's your turn. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I'm looking at climate change as the planet. It's, you know, the Earth science view. In the Earth science view, where the land is always shifting constantly. Look at Yellowstone, for example. Look at the volcano. Look at the stronger storms. We need more observations from space, and we need to start building some seawalls.
So, yeah, I'm never opposing more observations of Earth from space, since that's my area of expertise, for sure. And we all see land changes occurring, particularly around the coastlines or with extreme events like floodings and volcanoes. Of course, the land is moving, but at a much slower scale than what we're seeing with regard to current global warming, for sure.
Now, the Dutch had a devastating storm in February of 1954, I think it was. And you know that Holland is called the Low Countries for a reason, that some of it's below sea level. And so when they get a devastating Atlantic storm, the ocean just comes right over the edge of the country and floods the interior. And they built a really expensive but dynamic seawall after that event, and they've never had anything like it since. So that was an investment that paid off for them, because the storms have not gotten any weaker or less frequent. In fact, it may be the opposite. It's just that they're better protected. So there are some good things we can do to ensure against those kinds of tragedies.
Yeah, that's true. If you put up a wall, you can kind of keep it out until it gets over it.
Yeah,
and
that's
then
right.
You're staying in.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. You've got to make sure it's
you got to make sure you
well
get
done.
It out. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
well figured out, yeah.
Mark in Green Bay will go to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks a lot for the opportunity. A few weeks ago, I heard a guy on Science Friday talking about the energetics of the flight of vultures. It depends on barometric pressure, wind speed, et cetera, et cetera. And in the process of explaining it, he said that humid air is less dense than regular air. And that sounds counterintuitive. You always think of a heavy, humid day or fog settling down near the ground. Did he misspeak, or is that really true?
Yeah, that's correct. Isaac Newton was the first to actually say that, as far as I understand. That is true, because the molecular weight of water, H2O, is less than the average molecular weight of our atmosphere without water vapor in it, which is mostly nitrogen. So when you add a lot of water vapor, you're actually reducing the molecular weight of the air. Now, the way you feel being outside or something, you're right. You get tired easier. It just feels like you can't do anything, and we attribute that to the sense that the air is heavy. But in physical terms, it's actually lighter. It's just exactly the opposite.
It's more of the body not being
yeah,
able to cool down.
Yeah, it's physiological, right.
Physiological, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Karen emailed a couple of pictures. Jeff, maybe even put them both up at the same time first on our screen. And Karen emailed these two photos of a thunderstorm bowl and asked why the light is different between the two.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Mm. I also like the lightning bolt that's going in that second one.
That's awesome.
But yeah, in the inside the bowl, if you look carefully, if you can't see the picture, it's generally brighter than on the outside of the bowl. And the reason why that's the case is that in order to get that bright rainbow ring, you got to be taking light from someplace. And where it's coming from is outside that bowl. And so that area outside the bowl looks darker because it's that light that's interacting with the particles and generating the rainbow, not the light that's inside the bowl.
That's
a really good example. A lot of times it's not that bright.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you have a supernumerary bowl, there's more than one, or a really dramatic double rainbow. I get that sense that it's a little bit of a dramatic, a little bit of a double. But when it's more dramatic, that gap between the two bows is dark compared to the inside of the main bow, and it's a little bit less bright on the outside of the secondary bow. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Thanks
very much, Karen, for
sending that in. Question about high dew point. Southerly winds bring warm temperatures and water vapor as well up from the Gulf of Mexico, and this contributes to high dew points in the upper Midwest. And what's the significance, or why is that significant?
The dew point is a measure, an indirect measure of how much water vapor is in the air. So in a sense, it can tell you what's the likelihood that you're going to have some kind of weather associated with that importation of that air, because you need water vapor to start producing clouds and precipitation, sometimes thunderstorms in the summertime. So the combination coming on the heels of the southerly wind in this part of the world can result in a dramatic change, not only in the way the weather feels at the moment, but also in the complexion of how it might evolve over the next day or two. Whereas a southerly wind in Cairo is going to bring probably warm temperatures from places to the south, but it's going to be dry compared to if it were northerly off the Mediterranean. So it's not the same everywhere, but for us, it's going to be warm and moist at certain times of year.
Right. Yeah. Last week, we had several scattered thunderstorms in southern Wisconsin, and despite Doppler radar technology, it seems predicting how much rain will fall and whether and where during scattered thunderstorms, predicting that, how much we're going to get and where during scattered thunderstorms is difficult. Is that true, or...
Yeah, it's still pretty true, I think, in terms of accurate predictions of rainfall. And it's actually really variable. There's a really good network of you know, people who make their own observations and then report it, called COCORAS. It's a community thing. I forget what it stands for, but the H stands for hail, and there's an R for rainfall. but I do it. And, you know, that couple of weekends ago at my house, I had over 5 inches of rain. And then when I looked around, you know, in just in the Madison area, it rained. It rained anywhere from, you know, just a little less than 2 inches to a little over 5 inches. And so that's not that big of an area difference, given how much rain that was occurring.
That's
so it's very variable and therefore very hard to predict.
Yeah, it is not easy. And then on top of that, what you hope for on a day like that is to get the complexion right. And I don't even think that was right on that event. I don't remember expecting inches of rain, whether it was two or five on Saturday night into Sunday. That was a really dramatic event. And that had to do with exact placement and then propagation of the individual cells that you that are hard to predict on their own to begin with. So that was a really dramatic thing. I think it was our fifth rainiest day ever in Madison.
And we had a lightning bolt hit one of our cottonwood trees.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yep, and just boom, you know. Destroyed it. It turned out that cottonwood tree is infested with root rot as we went to UW for, department to find that out. So of the five trees to hit, that's the one it hit.
Perfect.
And we've already been told that tree has to come down.
That's great.
Now it will come down.
That's great.
Another question from an emailer. How accurate are weather radar apps on our smartphones?
I think they're right on target. They're just observations. And so it's, I don't know how much processing might go on in an individual application that ends up giving you an image on the phone, but they're all derived from the National Weather Service radars around the country. So I think those are just flat-out observations paid for by everybody and then processed by these various commercial entities. I can't imagine there'd be too much.
I can't imagine either. And the National Weather Service provides their own app.
That's true.
You know, so you're almost getting the raw data, so you can take a look at it yourself. There is there are other apps. I have several radar apps on my phone, and some of them do the smoothing, but generally, you know, it's telling you where it correlates very well with the National Weather Service raw data.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a favorite weather factoid? I've got, as an example, I've got one. I read that 40 million lightning strikes happen in the U.S. in the course of a year, which I thought was
pretty cool.
That is amazing.
I like that one.
I put you out of the spot. Right. Have you got a favorite one?
I do. I have my favorite one of all time is the 72.1 inches of snow that fell in 24 hours at Silver Lake, Colorado, sometime in 1926. I think it's the all-time most intense one-day snowfall in the United States.
6 feet fell in...
In 24 hours. 3 inches an hour for a full day. Incredible.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think what mine will be, the lightning that hit our one tree that has to come down.
That's pretty good. That's personalized. Right.
And the other one that I liked was about 2,000 thunderstorms rained down on the world, about 2,000. Every minute.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Oh, I mean, I would have guessed a day. That's the number that rings in my head. But a minute, boy, that's probably the same as the
that
day.
That ITCZ is a big area.
Yeah, it's a big area. It goes around
the
globe.
Yeah, right.
And I don't know who figured that one out, but, you know.
That's pretty cool.
Let's call it 2,000.
Let's call it 2,000.
Well, there's one other one I like. If all the water vapor that's in the atmosphere at any one instant in time, like right now as we're talking, were suddenly condensed into liquid water, it would be an inch of liquid water over the entire surface of the planet.
Whoa.
And then, let me follow that up. That amount is processed 40 times every year. Every 9 days, that amount of water is taken out of the cycle. That's astounding.
Yeah. And on that astounding note, we are out of time. Thanks, Steve and John. We'll look forward to your visit the last Monday of next month.
Sounds
October.
Great.
October. Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW, it's great to have them with us. Great to have the team that we've got as well. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. Our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. And I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on WPR News.